Every day that passes, we see more destruction, we see more fatalities, casualties, we see more displacement.
Basically, there is a real squeeze on natural resources, and climate change is exacerbating those scarcities.
We have countries normalizing the talk about nuclear weapons. This is our sacred mandate to prevent that this is not going to happen.
Hi, I'm Conor Lennon from UN News.
And hello, I'm Ben Dutsimalo, also from UN News.
And in this episode, we're going to focus on peace and security. We are living, after all, in times that UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described as uniquely dangerous.
Yes, we are all confronted today by the real risk of the world's major powers engaging in conflict. And this risk is at its highest level since the Cold War. The possibility of nuclear war breaking out is greater today than it has been for several decades. It's therefore no surprise that the subject of peace and security features heavily in the Pact for the Future just adopted a few days ago here in New York. Question is, how can we build a truly peaceful and secure world?
How indeed? Well, we're going to hear from some of the most senior and knowledgeable officials at the UN on how to address today's security threats. And despite all of the many subjects being discussed this week, Ben, it was impossible, wasn't it, to avoid the sense that the world outside is burning right now?
Well, on Tuesday, we had a Security Council meeting on Ukraine, where President Zelensky was in attendance. And on Wednesday evening, the Council met for a late session on Lebanon, where the people witnessed the bloodiest day for a generation. A situation that compels Secretary General Guterres to say that hell is breaking loose in Lebanon.
Now, earlier in the week, Jean-Pierre Lacroix, he's the head of UN Peace Operations, was in the SDG Media Zone, which has been holding events all week. He explained how the Pact for the Future addresses questions of peace and security. Barbara Nobrega from Globo News was asking the questions, and the impact of climate change came up, as did, inevitably, the situation in Lebanon.
The Pact for the Future puts the whole issues of how to respond to threats to peace and security into perspective. It talks about the biggest challenges to peace and security, the biggest threats, such as the impact of climate change, impact of transnational criminal activity, of course, inequality. And I think it's important when we think about the future of peace operation, which are one tool of the UN, think in terms of, you know, what is the environment? What is the big picture? And I believe that we have to think in terms of improved partnerships so that the peacekeepers and their role, you know, which is very much about protecting civilians and establishing, let's say, more stability in conflict environment, their role has to be complemented by much stronger actions to address the drivers of conflict. For example, climate change is having a massive impact on conflict. And, you know, it's so clear. We see that everywhere in the areas where we have peacekeepers.
The situation in southern Lebanon is currently dire. You have a peacekeeping mission there. What are they able to achieve and do to help to stop essentially a war from breaking out?
Well, obviously, right now, the priority for us, and I think for the whole region, is to stop this escalation and to achieve and to call for a cessation of hostilities, because every day that passes, we see more destruction, we see more fatalities, casualties, we see more displacement. We also believe that it is very unlikely that further escalation will eventually solve the problem in that region. Now, the peacekeepers, of course, their mission is to help the parties implement their obligation. There is a political framework for a solution to the conflict between Lebanon and Israel, and that's Security Council Resolution 1701. But the peacekeepers, they are there to support parties, but it's for the parties themselves to implement their obligation. So the more we are escalating towards greater level of hostility, then the more difficult it is for the peacekeepers to play their role, and they also have to protect themselves. The problem is that what we're seeing now is a very dangerous trend towards military escalation, which obviously will lead us and the region to more devastation and more losses of lives. We need to stop that.
Jean-Pierre Lacroix, the head of UN peace operations, and he was mentioning the peacekeepers in Lebanon, referring to UNIFIL, which is the UN interim force in Lebanon. I mean, hard to believe, Ben, it's actually been in existence since 1978.
The Pact for the Future has plenty to say on the issue of peacekeeping and peace building, with commitments from UN member states on protecting civilians in armed conflicts, diffusing tensions, and sustaining peace at a national level.
Well, earlier I spoke to Elizabeth Speha. She's the Assistant Secretary General for Peace Building Support about the Pact and also the UN document that informed much of the language in it. The Secretary General's new agenda for peace, which recommends greater support, including financial support for peace building. Now, there is often confusion between peacekeeping and peace building, as I've learnt to my cost. So I started by asking her to give us a definition of the term.
I would define peace building as making countries peaceful and stable through a holistic approach where you're bringing together the notions of peace, as in an absence of conflict, harmony, reconciliation, together with looking at the root causes of conflict, and therefore also looking at what you need to do about the economy, inclusive opportunities, social cohesion. So for the UN, basically bringing all our tools together so that we can help countries build sustainable peace that also has to be built on sustainable development. I can give you a very concrete example of the situation in the Liptako-Gourma region of the Sahel, which spans several countries. Basically, there is a real squeeze on natural resources. There's scarcity in terms of both land and water, and climate change is exacerbating those scarcities. We have both herders of livestock and farmers that are using the same land and availing themselves of also the water resources. And those two communities are increasingly entering into conflict because of that competition over the resources. So we have been helping local actors on the ground with some of our UN partners to help build early warning systems so that the communities know ahead of time how these livestock movements are going, what might be the impact for the farmers, and to already try and work on dispute resolution or, in fact, the prevention of a clash over the use of the land and the water resources.
And that's something that is not just going to be affecting the kind of countries that we often hear about when we talk about the UN in terms of humanitarian aid or peacekeeping. One could argue that there are many, many more countries that are vulnerable to the kind of tensions that you're talking about in terms of inequality, feelings of exclusion, political unrest, etc.
You're absolutely right. And this is another very important point in a new agenda for peace. The Secretary General basically called on all member states, all 193 of them, wherever they are in the world, to think about prevention and to think about investing in what he has been calling national prevention strategies. That can mean many different things. It can look differently in different countries depending on their needs. But the point is, yes, all countries have their vulnerabilities. All countries have their fragilities.
International peace and security has been one of the key themes of the Summit of the Future. And of course, many, many people at a high level have been talking about the theme throughout the week. What view is going to be the next staging post after this week? What do you expect to come out of it? And what's the big milestone to come?
We really hope that the political commitments that are in the pact will be translated into action. And we have another milestone coming up next year, which is the peacebuilding architecture review that member states do every 5 years. And we're hoping that whatever political commitments on peacebuilding come out of the pact can be further worked on through this review next year and strengthen our tools, strengthen the Secretariat to be able to support prevention and peacebuilding strategies that member states might want to have resourced and supported with technical assistance and advice. We also hope that we can work on the spirit of the pact and a new agenda for peace, which talks very concretely about making sure that we constantly look at sustainable development as one of the key motors towards peace, and that we need to work towards peaceful solutions so that we can actually create a foundation for sustainable development.
Elizabeth Spejar, Assistant Secretary General for Peacebuilding Support, on the potential impact that the Pact for the Future will have on UN peacebuilding efforts around the world.
The need to free the world of the threat of nuclear war is included in the Pact for the Future, with a reminder that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. Thursday was Nuclear Weapons Elimination Day, and it was commemorated with a high-level meeting in the General Assembly. Rafael Grossi, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, was at UN headquarters, and he spoke to our colleague Nagiz Shekinskaya, who asked him first about the risk of a nuclear disaster in Ukraine, where shelling has been taking place near a large nuclear power plant, and also the possibility of nuclear weapons being used in a conflict.
We have had a number of events, either shelling or drones or the interruption of external power supply, which could entail the risk of meltdown. Several situations, we have been able to deploy a permanent team from the IAEA, which is constantly checking the situation, interacting with the management of the plant, and trying to do just that, prevent an accident. And now we had the unexpected addition of the situation in Kursk, of course, where I also was in the recent past. So the problem in this case is the militarization of nuclear facilities, and this is something that we need to prevent. I have been here in New York several times briefing the Security Council, and here last year I introduced a number of principles that need to be followed in order to avoid a nuclear accident with radiological consequences. We see the possibility of nuclear accidents, which did not exist before, as a way of expression of military activity. This is completely new in the recent years, at least. And then we have references to the possible use of nuclear weapons. We have countries normalizing the talk about nuclear weapons, and also of having them, acquiring them, countries which do not have them. And this is our, I would say, sacred mandate at the IAEA to prevent, as guarantors of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, that this is not going to happen. Imagine a world with all these tensions where you have 15, 20 countries with nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons use would probably happen. So I think we need to, at these times of difficulties and crisis, we need to reinforce our commitment. The institutions that protect those, like the IAEA, the UN, and Secretary General Guterres has been of great support to me personally and to the agency, and we are very grateful for that.
Rafael Grossi, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, in conversation there with my colleague Nagiz Shekinskaya.
So, Ben, we have made it to the end of the week, and, I mean, you've been here... Well, our week started last Friday, didn't it? Because we worked through the weekend. I've forgotten what day it is, actually. Tell me about some of your highlights, because you've been everywhere, it seems, interviewing half the people here.
Three things for me. The President of the United States, Joe Biden, was here, and he gave a speech that I think everybody would acknowledge was pretty well-balanced, quite forward-looking. One thing he said... He said, my fellow leaders, there are some things more important than staying in power. And for me, as a Ghanaian, as a Pan-Africanist, and looking at the age of Africa, the population, the majority are youth, where we need younger leaders in positions instead of the older folks, nothing against older folks. I think what Joe Biden said, and on many issues, he was pretty well balanced. Number two for me, was an interview I've done with Gordon Brown about education. Yes, by the grace of God, I'm here, but education brought me this far. And they are investing $1.6 billion into education across the globe as a way of solving many of the problems that we have. And it was fascinating meeting Gordon Brown for the first time, seeing how genial, how genuine, how committed he is to education as a tool for making things better across the world. And then last for me, young people, youth at UN headquarters. I was here last Saturday, the energy of the young people is something that you just want them to take over the UN. Not in a flippant way. Again, nothing against older people. But when I mingle with the young people here, the energy, the sense of optimism, the sense of dynamism, the sense that we can't afford to give up, even though things look bleak, and that sense of we should do everything we can, whether peace and security, whether climate action, whether nuclear proliferation, whether Ukraine, Gaza, or Sudan, or Haiti, that sense that, yes, we can't give up, we must have hope and tackle these things, it just reinforced the fact that many of us, if not all of us here at the UN, must be eternal optimists to work in this global organization.
Well, I learned a new word, intergenerational, which is something that we've been hearing a lot. So these older people you mentioned, talking to younger people, and both sets of generations have something to teach the other. And just to go back to Biden, another thing I picked out from that was that he entered politics as a senator in 1972. Ben, that's the year I was born. I'm not that young, but my goodness, that's
he was a young man.
He was in his 20s
when he entered politics in the U.S. We need more people like him, and he's happy to be leaving the stage. As he said, this is his last General Assembly and a good example.
Well, I've picked out for me the main moment. Let's go back to the beginning, back to Sunday. We were working Friday, Saturday, because there were these action days before the Summit of the Future proper started, with many of those youth advocates probably that you spoke to.
Yeah.
So went to bed on Saturday, got up super early on Sunday morning, only to see that there had been an amendment dropped on Saturday night. The President of the General Assembly had hauled the negotiators back into the room, and I was frantically calling around people in the Secretary General's office, the President of the General Assembly's office. Nobody knew what was going on. But the President of the General Assembly did manage to get it over the line on Sunday morning. But there was a lot more drama than we'd been expecting. Well, on Thursday, I caught a few words with Guy Ryder. He's the UN Undersecretary General of Policy, and he's the big boss of the Summit of the Future. I have to say, he was still looking pretty chipper on Thursday, despite the relentless interview rounds.
This is, what, your 1,000th interview today? Congratulations. You still sound like you're alive. Okay, first of all, we're near the end of the week. How's your week gone? And be honest.
Well, I think the feeling at this stage of the week is that something of relief. We got this summit done. We got a pact adopted. I think that's great. A certain sense of achievement because this pact means something, but also a feeling of the challenges ahead because it's great, of course, to adopt a document, but in the end what matters is what we do next, and is our system able to really act on the opportunities we've given ourselves this week to actually make the difference in the future? And that question remains to be answered.
Now, getting the pact wasn't a foregone conclusion, as we were led to believe. Saturday night, take you back there, I'm sure you remember it very well, an amendment dropped, and then the PGA called the negotiators back in, hauled them in. I think it was a very late night. How was it for you?
Yeah, I mean, I've been in negotiations for about 40 years, so it was sort of familiar territory. But look, this was never a foregone conclusion. It was a sort of a cliffhanger to the last minute. I think that a lot of people contributed to a successful outcome in different ways. Our member states, the Secretary General himself. But yeah, it was a nervy moment. I think right up to the final adoption in the General Assembly Hall on Sunday, it could have gone either way. The Secretary General had three different speeches ready according to which way it went. A yes, a no, or a maybe. And I think it shows you that, yeah, it was a pretty nervy moment. But it ended well, so we should be happy about that.
And international peace and security, Lebanon, Gaza, do you think that that's kind of overshadowed all the discussions about the pact for the future, the summit of the future, or has it fed into it?
Look, I think we're all clear that this summit is taking place against a pretty somber background in the world. We would be foolish not to be cognizant of that. And, you know, the latest headlines from the Lebanon only underline it. There is an important piece on peace and security in the pact itself, but I don't think that's the point. The point is, even with the divisions in the world, even with these incredibly destructive conflicts taking place in the world, to get 193 member states together, and with all of the difficulties that we know about, to have come out with a consensus on what is not an empty document, it's a very contentful document, I think is really an achievement and shows is something of a bright light in this rather somber context. And that is, I think, something very well worth having and reflecting upon.
Guy Ryder, Supremo of the Summit of the Future, revealing that the Secretary General actually had three speeches ready on Sunday morning, depending on what the outcome of the Pact for the Future would be. So there we go. He didn't know. Right up until the adoption actually happened, he didn't know which speech he would need. Now, before we go, Ben, a reminder that some of the most serious threats we face in the world can't actually be seen with the naked eye.
That is true. A lot of people, 1.3 million people, are dying every year because of something that cannot be seen with the naked eye. It is called antimicrobial resistance, otherwise known as AMR, directly responsible for 1.3 million deaths and a contributing factor for 5 million other fatalities every year. Antimicrobial resistance occurs when microorganisms like bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites no longer respond to antibiotics or to antimicrobial medicines. Basically, right now you go to hospitals, some sicknesses are easily treated with antibiotics. We are getting to that point where these antibiotics are no longer effective because of resistance from these situations. This means that infections are becoming more difficult or impossible to treat, increasing the risk of disease spread, severe illnesses, disability, and even death.
The General Assembly met on Thursday for a high-level meeting on the topic of AMR, and they adopted a political declaration which is aimed at tackling this major public health threat. My colleague Eileen Travers has written a great explainer on the topic for UN News, and we have the link in the show notes. On Friday, the general debate continues, and then it goes on Saturday, and then the actual official finish of the whole shebang is on Monday. Yeah, it sounds like they're packing up already, doesn't it? We're actually right near the canteen, so there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing of various people there. So yeah, we have the GA debate page in the show notes, and it has the full list of speakers.
Friday is the last day of the SDG media zone as well. Women's role in sustainable fashion innovation, that will be at 10 o'clock.
That's one for you, fashionable man.
I try. So find out about the UN's presence at Expo 2025, which is happening in Osaka, Japan. And that will be coming up there at 10:30.
And we have that list as well in the show notes, the full program of the SDG Media Zone. Ben, thank you very much. I can't believe it's taken us this long to do a show together. I hope it won't be the last. And this is it from the lobby of the 42nd Street entrance to the UN Secretariat building. You're listening to The Lid Is On, the flagship news podcast from the United Nations.